Here you go.
Thank you. So first, I would like to thank the organizers for having given me the opportunity to give this talk, and also the KITP for hosting me for the program, which is very nice. And I'm going to go very briefly remind you what SDB stars are, very, very briefly. And I will spend most all of my time actually talking about the adiabatic asteroseismology of SDB stars. So I loosely use the term adiabatic asteroseismology in opposition of non-adiabatic asteroseismology, which I will not talk about at all because I don't have the time for that. But what I will not talk about is actually all the information we can get from the driving of the MODs. That's Eily already talked a bit, in fact, Monday. And then I will summarize. So SDB stars, they are actually in that part of the HR diagram, and they are essentially the helium core of a former red giant that has been, which is almost naked because the envelope has been almost totally expelled for some reason that I will not go into. And so they are typically found around these parameters, so they are very hot and compact. And quite interestingly for us, they have the very good idea to, well, some of these stars have the very good idea to pulsate. And actually, there are two kinds of distinct pulsators among these stars. The first one are P-mode pulsators with periods quite short in the 1 to 10 minutes range, which are found in that part of the TF log G region. And the other groups are G-mode pulsators with periods quite longer in the range of 1 to 4 hours, which are cooler than the P-mode pulsators typically. There are also some hybrid pulsators at the interface of the two regions, essentially. Well, okay. So in terms of the pulsation properties in these stars, so those objects, even though they are compact, they are not degenerate like white dwarfs, so they somehow behave like the normal stars, in a sense that the P-modes actually are mostly envelope modes, which you can see the propagation diagram here where there are the P-modes up there in their oscillation cavity, and the G-modes are found here, and the G-modes are probe much deeper region. They are essentially core modes. The modes are sensitive, of course, to the main stellar parameters of the stars. What I show here is actually some example of P-modes as the period of the P-modes as function of the temperature and the surface gravity of the stars. And you see you can have very large variations depending on where SDB star is in the log GTF plane. This is mostly due to the fact that high log G subdwarfs has a much smaller radius than a low log G subdwarfs. Of course, the periods are also sensitive to some other parameters of the stars, like the mass that I don't show here, but it's important to notice that. There could be some regions of the log GTF domain where actually you can find avoided crossings. You actually have an example of these things occurring here. And but this happens mainly in the high temperature and low log G domain, which is rich only for the stars that are close to the terminal edge of the extreme horizontal branch, so they are running out of helium in the core and past these regions also, so when the star evolved post they're starting to burn helium in a shell. So G-modes also show some kind of sensitivity to the main stellar parameters, which are a bit different from the P-mode behaviors, but that are important. So when you observe a star with the period that you get actually give you some information on where this star should be on this log GTF region, gives you also some information on the mass. But what is also very interesting in this object is that the modes are sensitive to chemical transitions. So in that respect, subdwarfs are more like white dwarfs because they are stratified objects. And there are actually two regions. If you look at the Brin-Weissala profile, you see those spikes. Those spikes are actually coming from this term, which is the Ledoux term, which is which is essentially zero everywhere, except where you have composition gradients. And those structures actually are have an impact on the pulsation spectrum because they are producing trapping effects. And we have two regions where we find those important composition gradients. Those are at the boundary of the hydrogen-rich envelope of the stars, between the hydrogen-rich envelope and the helium mantle, and much deeper, where actually you have the boundary of the mixed core, because helium is in the, well, the star is in the process of transforming helium into carbon and oxygen, so there is a transition, composition transition that's building up also in that region, at the boundary of the core. So this has an impact on the P-modes, what I call micro-trapping P-modes, but maybe we could also call that acoustic glitches, like I've seen yesterday. It's not like in the red giants, because those glitches actually are shown here. What I show here is for different size of the envelope, so thick envelope to thin envelope, the impact on the P modes. So this is delta nu versus the period of the P modes, in fact. And this region between the green lines is actually what the star is showing us by pulsating. I mean, not all modes. Those modes here are usually not seen in the star. So you see that a very different glitch is happening as a function of the size of the of the envelope. So which is important because it gives us access actually to the mass of the hydrogen-rich envelope, even if we have P modes. The problem is that P-modes are envelope modes that don't go very deep inside the star, so they are mostly insensitive to what is happening much deeper, close to the core transitions. So G-modes in this respect provide much more interesting probes, because they go much deeper, and this can be seen, for instance, in this diagram, which shows the what we call the white function of the modes, white functions. The white function is a function of the eigenfunctions that essentially tells you where the frequency of a mod is produced inside inside the star. And there are different kinds of There are different kinds of G modes. Some are trapped and have a very distinct signature in this diagram. They are trapped in the envelope of the star, and some others are more confined below this envelope and actually are quite sensitive. You see the value of the white function is much larger, especially close to the core and its boundary. And this has of, so that means the modes are sensitive also to the what's happening near the core. And this, well, so the G modes give you access to both the mass of the hydrogen-rich envelope, and what I'm showing here is actually also the delta P G mode spectrums, but shown as the period spacing as function of the period. And again, in between the green lines is what SDB star pulsating G mode SDB star usually show us mostly. And you see very different patterns occurring as a function of the hydrogen-rich envelope mass, for instance, from a thin envelope to a thick envelope this time. But well, I can note that actually, depending, these patterns are also sensitive to the shape of the transitions, depending if it is a sharp transition or a smooth transition. And if so, this show you actually what's going on when you make the transition smoother. So this is very from very sharp to completely smooth, in fact. So you can actually see that there is some impact on the periods on G-mod spectrum. But the interesting thing of the G-mod is that they also are also sensitive to the core CO to helium transitions, and which gives you some similar type of behavior in the G-mod spectrum, but yes, okay. But it's similar but different from the trapping that we usually see with the envelope. So there is a distinct signature that occurs due to the core transition, and This is interesting because it gives you access to the size of the mix core. Again, this is also dependent on the shape of the transition. So from a sharp transition down to something quite smooth. Okay, the difficulty is that all these effects in SDB stars tend to interfere with each other. So what you actually have in a model of SDB star is a combination of all this. So the trapping is quite complex. And when it comes to try to, from the pulsation frequencies, to determine the structural parameters of the stars, it becomes a quite complex problem due to the what I just said, the trapping structures, which interfere in a complicated way. But also, there are other complications, like the p-modes, for instance, and some of the low or the g-modes tend to be out of the asymptotic regime. And sometimes we have mixed modes also in some part of the parameter space. And the observed pulsation spectra that we usually have are generally incomplete, in the sense that not all modes of a spectrum are seen. So some modes are lacking, so it makes them difficult to identify. And independent mode identification, especially of the degree of the mode, is usually not available for these stars. So simple seismic diagnostic tools are quite difficult to apply in those conditions, although there have been some attempts for that. And the problem has to be handled with the for-one modeling approach, so trying to match directly the models that we calculate to the observed period spectra. So I'm not going to detail the principle of this. But essentially, what you have to do is to compare the observed periods with the periods you calculate for a model of given parameters. And you try to match them with the complication here that we don't know what, a priori, what are usually the L values for the mode and so on. So the what we adopt as a strategy is actually we optimizing the match in order to get the best possible fit for a given model. This match is quantified by merit functions, which is a function, of course, of stellar parameters. So, and then we have to look at in the whole parameter space and try to find the best possible fit to a given set of observed periods. There are many ways to do it. The brute force way, which is to build very large grids. We're actually using a more efficient way for exploring this parameter space, which is based on a genetic algorithm. And just to give you an idea of what the code does, actually, this is just an example of a complex function for which, for instance, I want to find the maxima. So that function here, this is just projection of this function. And what the code does is essentially it tries to spot all the possible peaks in there. So at the end, what we have, the idea is to capture all the relevant solutions that we can have in a given parameter space, and to have some information on how unique is the solution that we eventually pick. So there are several strategies to use models for finding best fit solutions. Recently, Ailey Wu and Stephen Bluben will talk about that. Are trying to use evolutionary models actually to achieve this objective. In our group, we have been more focused on using static models, which have some advantages when we want to do asteroseismology, because they offer more flexibility than evolutionary models, in the sense that you can parameterize some aspect of the models that you can't in evolutionary models. So maybe to have an easier way actually to map the parameter space. Another advantage is that with static models, we don't need a grid, so we don't have a grid resolution problem. And we can use the genetic algorithm code actually to explore continuously the parameter space. So even if the solution is in a very narrow regions, we have a chance to spot it. While with a grid, you might pass over easily on that. So historically, SDB stars I've been probed by asteroseismologists since about 10 years. It started in 2001 with GRIDS, not with genetic algorithms. So this is the list of all the stars. I'm not going to go through that, of course. There have been 13 PMOD pulsators mostly analyzed with that, and only 3 GMOD pulsators analyzed with that very recently, and thanks to the space observations, in fact. I'm not just going to go through very quickly over some examples. So maybe the most interesting object in the PMOD domain for the PMOD pulsators is this star, PG1336 or NY Virginis. It's an SDB star in a close binary system with a DM companion, and it is eclipsing, pulsating on eclipsing. So we are in a situation where actually we have different ways of determining the parameters of the star. So, a seismic solution has been searched and found. And essentially, those are the parameters that we obtain from seismology. And the interesting aspect is to compare that with what we can get from the analysis of the orbit of the system. And there has been a paper from Vukovic et al. In 2007 that actually does that. And they couldn't find a single solution. They found 3 that could that were equally fitting, actually, the orbital light curve. But the interesting thing is one of their solutions is extremely close to one of the seismic solutions, to the seismic solutions, especially in terms of the mass, the 2 values. So here we have a case where there is a convergence of 3 techniques. The other techniques is actually spectroscopy, which gives you a log G, for instance. And all the three techniques somehow converge to the same values within the errors in that case. So that gives us some confidence that we're not so far from, it's not that bad. And it gives also a sense on in terms of the accuracy of the measurements, you know, in the precision versus accuracy thing, in the sense that we're somehow calibrating our different methods, and there seems to be quite close. So, okay. Well, there are also other things about asters I will not really talk about because it will be too long. But we have been able to show that the rotation of the SDB stars is very likely synchronized down to around 50% of the radius of the star, which is what you expect for a system that closely that is so close to each other, and the 2 stars so close to one another. Okay, and in terms of the GMOD pulsators, so things moved on quite spectacularly with the advent of the space observations. Namely, Kepler and Corot observed one of these stars too. So it's quite recent. And the reason why space observations were so important is that it's extremely difficult to follow these GMOD pulsators from the ground because of their periods, their very low amplitudes, and they are quite faint in general and hard to observe. And so the same techniques have been applied by Valérie essentially to try to find best fitting models of the G modes observed in all of these stars. So that's one of the examples where a solution seems to clearly stand out. And the novelty here is with G mode, as I said earlier, you have a sensitivity to what's happening to the core. So you actually have a solution that show up in the size of the core essentially versus its composition, which kind of clearly shows up here, which is the consequence of this. So another example, this was the Corot star. And the last example with another Kepler star, where we couldn't actually decipher between 2 possible solutions. So there you have 2 valleys. It's an example where you cannot always find a clear solution that emerge in the parameter space. So the main outcome of all this, of course, are the structural parameters of the star. But in particular, what's happening in the core parameters. And what we find that the mixed core, seems to be more extended by, well, it depends on the star, but say roughly 50% than what we would expect from standard SDB evolutionary models that are based only on convections plus eventually some semi-convections occurring in the late stage. So there should be some additional sources of mixing here, something that we have to investigate more in the future. But that's one of the, and it seems to happen for all, it's happening for all the three stars, and we want to check if it's happening for other stars as well, so that we are somewhat confident that this is something real and not something that has happened only by chance in one object or two objects. So I'm going to skip that. It's just an example of the mod identification after we found the best fit solutions. So everything is not perfect, of course. So the models can provide quite close fits to the observations, but even though the fits are close, they are still not close enough to the resolution of the observation. So there is definitely things that are lacking in the models that are making us not being able to fit the frequencies of the mod, the precision of the observations. It's probably where many different aspects or several aspects that we are that have been not ignored but not very well modeled in the current models that we have may enter. And this would be very nice to try to improve these things in the future and see if we can improve the model quality, the fit in the same token. So just to finish on that, I'm just recalling essentially some of the thing that the P mod and G mod in SDB stars can give us, the kind of information it can bring us. And there are other things I didn't really mention, or just very briefly. For instance, internal rotation of SDB stars, as I said, in binaries, this can provide us constraints on tidal synchronization, for instance, and Steve actually is working on a couple of three SDB stars in binary systems where synchronization doesn't seem to have occurred yet. So this is an interesting problem to study this way. And core rotation from GMOD. So this is, I think, something which will be quite important in the future. Because with the long Kepler data that we now have, we're starting to see some splittings. And the surprise seems to be that these objects will rotate quite slow in general, except when they are in very close binaries where there's some tidal effect that can spin them up or keep them rotating fast. So that's interesting because those objects are quite very compact. They just moved away from the red giant. But still, they are rotating slowly, apparently. And by slowly, I mean very slowly. It's weeks. Yeah. And in terms of the non-adiabatic asteroseismology, I just want to maybe recall what Eileen mentioned in our talk. Well, the driving mechanism in this star is due to the iron opacity. And to be effective, it has to be reinforced by radiative levitation. So actually, the driving of the oscillations in these stars very strongly depends on what's going on in terms of the radiative levitations and in terms of the competing process that can go against these levitations, and in particular, the thermohaline convection point, for instance. So we have here some, it's probably the only objects, pulsating objects that we know that have a so direct link to these physical aspects of the interior of stars. And of course, it has some relation also to the atomic physics through the opacities that we have heard about on Monday. So iron is very important in this case, but there are other elements that are also very important. It's nickel and maybe chromium and manganese also. So in terms of opacities, those should really be looked at very closely, I think. I'm going to stop.
I actually think the correspondence between the parameters derived from seismic models and the parameters derived from orbital, the fact that both match so well is sometimes surprising, because in close binaries you'd expect at least some effect of the well, maybe the heat dissipation created by the tides rate on the stars to contribute to at least to the evolution of the system or to the structure of the system, and that's not taken into account in the forward models. Right?
Yeah, most of the SDB stars are probably formed in binary systems because this is the preferred way to expel the envelope of the red giant at this stage. So there has been some combined evolution at some point in their history. Now, when they are at the stage of being a SDB, they are very compact objects. Now, the DM companion is like one fifth of its of the mass of an SDB. So in terms of a tidal interaction, it's not really doing that much to the SDB, which is so compact. So in that sense, I don't think we would expect very strong effect on the evolution of the star itself, on even on its structure. It could have an effect on the pulsation modes, but it's I think we have evaluated that with Daniel some time ago, but it was for an even a system as compact as the binary I showed, but the companion was a massive white dwarf, so it had already quite stronger effects in terms of tidal interactions, and the effects were of the around the second order effect of the rotation of the object, so it's not that big, in fact. So it's even less there because it's not a white dwarf, a massive white dwarf. It's
an M dwarf. Hi, just a general comment on the fitting. I mean, the fitting method you use, which is similar to one used by a lot of people in solar-like stars, is to take all of the frequencies and try to minimize the chi-squared. And sometimes you end up with two possible solutions. A related approach, which we talked about yesterday, is to look at the main features of the frequencies. For example, the separations or the glitches or oscillations or period spacings or whatever, and to try to use them rather than giving all frequencies equal weight. Would that allow you in this case, do you think, to solve this two solution problem?
In principle, yes. The difficulty, as I mentioned, is that with all those trappings interfering, it can be quite difficult actually to use the usual diagnostic tools that you are talking about. There is also another problem, is the mode identifications that we don't have a priori. Mm-hmm. It makes hard to make differences when you don't know, to which branch the modes are, L branch the modes are actually associated. And the spectra are not always continuous. Some modes are missing in the middle, for instance, for some reason. And so it's even makes the picture more difficult to solve, I mean. So, yes, in principle, but...
Yeah, these are complicated.
Yeah.
Concerning the core rotation, do you see some sign of differential rotation between the surface and the core, or...?
It's too early to answer this question, because we are just starting to see some splittings with our many months of Kepler data. And we still have to exploit that, I mean, the right way. I was just giving very coarse information. So I can't really answer. And the problem is, if they are rotating very slowly, if you want to see some differential rotations, then you really have to have a very long baseline, because the effect will be between a mode which samples more the envelope and the mode that samples more the core. The difference in the splitting will be so small that if you want to really resolve that, you have a very, very good accuracy on the frequency you measure, so a very long time baseline. So it's too early to say.
Okay. Could you quickly scan back to the slide where you introduced your, just the one before the genetic algorithm one? It shows the little trial function. That is absolutely terrifying. Yeah, that, no, back.
This?
No, the one with the trial function. That one.
That?
If that, the test function you're calling it. That's absolutely terrifying. But then later, you're going to show a slide where you've got these two nice valleys where we've got a two-way ambiguity as opposed to a thousand-way ambiguity like this. If that, it would just really be interesting to see, as opposed to a made-up test function, what that kind of landscape looks like if you take different slices as you have discovered them using your genetic algorithm to give guidance to those of us who foolishly think we might be able to use an optimization algorithm to search for an answer which would actually die in that kind of mess but would probably not be too bad on the one with the couple of things. Next question, I'm going to say both questions worth me to answer. The slide just before this, I guess it is. Yeah, that one, where you mentioned that M is greater than N. Yeah. More theoretical periods available than we've got observations. This is going to be, I'm wondering about the applicability of the, what your schemes are here over to the red giant case, where as we move the red giant branch, M is going to be a thousand times bigger than N. So looking for just the best period matches is going to be nuts. We're going to have to start using other things like the energy or what, or how do we deal with this mess?
You have to be careful RGB. When doing that, if you're in a situation where you have so many theoretical models and so few observed models that you can basically match anything. But the situation is not that, is not...
You're saying that in STBs you don't have that problem, whereas the people on the RGB are going to...
Actually, this gives you an example of, this are some models that have been observed on those, this is a theoretical spectrum, so you see the density is not of the solution on the...
In your case, M is actually just a little bit larger than N, as opposed to 100 times larger than N, like we're going to be getting on the RGB.
The reason that why you have to have M larger than N is you cannot fit
N observed
mods.
The problem is if M gets infinite, then finding good matches to frequencies becomes pretty easy.
Okay, with that, let's thank Stefan, please.